Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel, Michael Broman on behalf of the appellant in this case, Dr. DiBartolo. In 2001, Dr. DiBartolo became a passive investor in the HealthSouth partnership when his privileges were not renewed because he was not able to schedule surgeries at the facility at issue. The amendment at issue in this case became adopted in 2004 at a time when Dr. DiBartolo was already a passive investor.
Mr. Broman, what is this case doing in federal court?
Well, you're right, Your Honor. I think from a standpoint, it is a contract dispute. It was brought in federal court because of...
contract dispute, and there's no diversity of citizenship.
Right, and it was brought on...
Now, I could understand the dispute being in federal court if you were saying there's a private right of action to enforce the Anti-Kickback Act.
Which we're not saying.
But your brief disclaims that.
That's absolutely correct.
So all we have is a potential federal issue in a claim arising under state law, and I don't see how that can be litigated in federal court.
Well, which I think is what the district court was implying in his opinion when he questioned whether there was subject matter jurisdiction. And, you know, the case was brought because of the fact that the contract at issue, the illegality, the federal policies that we are claiming were violated here are...
Well, that just makes it look like Merrill Dow or Empire Health Choice or Bennett against Southwest Airlines or any of quite a number of... large number of other cases, none of which your brief discusses.
And what we've said in our brief, of course, Your Honor, is the fact that, yes, if you think this is a case where there is no subject matter jurisdiction, then, yes, this case should be affirmed just on that basis, not on the private right of action.
You're the one who brought it here. You're the proponent of federal jurisdiction. So tell me why you think there's federal jurisdiction.
I think there's federal jurisdiction because of the federal statute that is implicated by this contract.
A federal statute being implicated by a contract is not enough for federal jurisdiction. The Supreme Court held that in Merrill Dow. It held that in Empire Health Choice. We held that in Bennett against Southwest Airlines. If that's all you've got, there's no federal jurisdiction. Is there anything else?
Well, and I mean, there's the issues that, of course, had they attempted to enforce these sales under the statute, the federal question necessarily arises. They've conceded and they've acknowledged in their brief that they think that federal subject matter jurisdiction exists here. But we acknowledge, Your Honor, that if you don't believe that there is federal subject matter jurisdiction, that should be the sole basis for an affirmance here. The district court affirmed.
Look, the federal statute says that there's jurisdiction of, quote, a claim arising under federal law. What is the theory under which your claim arises under federal law?
The theory is that this amendment, as applied to these particular circumstances, is void because it violates the federal anti-kickback statute.
You haven't told me why you think your claim arises under federal law.
Because
it looks to me like your claim arises under the contract or the law of partnership.
Which is why we acknowledged in our brief that if this case were affirmed, it should be affirmed on the issue of subject matter jurisdiction, and let's go litigate this issue back in the state courts. And as opposed to deciding this case on this question of the private right of action.
Do you think that Judge Sagal rendered a decision on the merits, or do you think he dismissed it for lack of jurisdiction? What do you think he did here?
I think he did not intend to do this on the merits. I think Judge Sagal had the very same concern that Judge Easterbrook had, is what is this case doing in federal
court? Well, it seems to me that a plain reading of the decision certainly suggests that the court dismissed it on the merits.
The judgment reads, it is ordered and adjudged, the complaint is dismissed for failure to state a claim upon which relief may be granted.
Right.
And the merits, that's
right,
not
but he also, I think, acknowledged early on in the opinion that he was not issuing a ruling on merits, but I understand what you're saying.
You know, when he considered the jurisdictional question, he said it's questionable that a complaint by HealthSouth could be brought in federal court.
Exactly.
So, I mean...
I think he was bothered that this case was brought in federal court.
Well,
and, I mean, if you remember how this motion...
Any judge is bothered.
If you remember how this motion to dismiss was raised in the first instance, it was raised on a claim of lack of standing. That was the specific allegation in the motion to dismiss. Then Judge Zagel took the lack of standing and went into the analysis of the private right of action, and then he raised in his own mind the question of federal subject matter jurisdiction.
Are you in a position where you can still bring this to state court?
We think so, yes. Yes. And that's what basically what we're saying. If you affirm this case, if what we're saying is affirm it on the subject matter jurisdiction.
You can't affirm it on lack of subject matter jurisdiction because the district court decided it on the merits.
Well,
this would require us to vacate and remand with instructions to dismiss.
Right. And what
that's
I'm
very different from affirming.
And then what I'm saying to you is you should reverse this decision on the basis of the
and remand with instructions to dismiss.
That's fine. But
the brief asks us to reverse, but that's something one does on the merits.
But why couldn't you have done that yourselves? I mean, what? I'm having trouble wondering
because
why you're here today.
This is
why you made us read all of this.
This, because of the federal issues that underpin this case, and obviously the determination was made at the time that the best place for a court to interpret the underpinnings of the anti-kickback statute, the underpinnings of the safe harbors that they were asserting would justify the conduct at issue.
I'm completely lost. It's been settled for more than 100 years that the existence of a federal issue in a case does not support federal jurisdiction. How could one determine this in the teeth of more than a century of Supreme Court precedent?
As I said, I think that that's the basis the Judge Zagel, if he was concerned about...
It wasn't Judge Zagel who filed this lawsuit in federal court. It was you.
That's correct. That's correct. We filed the case in federal court because of the underpinning of the statute. And if it was Judge Zagel's viewpoint that this thing didn't belong in federal court, that's what we think where this case should be going. With respect to the issue of the private cause of action, which Judge Zagel ruled upon, as we set forth in our brief, there certainly is a distinction between enforcing this statute, as you saw in the case of West versus Alice, and a situation where you have a party claiming that a contractual provision is void against federal public policy, as the court acknowledged in the Cox versus Zale case. We have a situation here where...
Look, Cox is fundamentally different from this case.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is. The Anti-Kickback Act in this case was not enacted to regulate conduct between private parties, but rather to prevent Medicare fraud against the government. And that's an important distinction. In Cox, what the court noted was that although that section of the bankruptcy code did not create a private right to seek damages for violation of the requirement that a debt reaffirmation agreement be filed with the bankruptcy court, the section was a statute regulating purely private rights, and it could therefore be used to rescind a contract that was formed illegally. And that, you know, as I noted, the Anti-Kickback Act wasn't enacted to regulate conduct between private parties. So
what the anti-kickback
it's just fundamentally different.
No, what the anti-kickback statute was designed to do was to prevent there to be illegal referrals. And we have a situation here. In fact, the OIG special alert in 1994 specifically addressed the situation of using a structure like this to get rid of investors who might not be referring to the clinic. In Cox versus Zale, Judge Posner specifically noted that the distinction, he said, the private rights of action that the Supreme Court is reluctant to read into federal statutes are rights to obtain damages for statutory violations remediable by public agencies. There's no attempt in this case to try to get any of the remedies under the anti-kickback statute. In fact, I think, obviously the closest case on point is the Zimmer case, which we cited to the court, and which was a district court case in Indiana, which is directly on all fours, went to summary judgment, and the court held that the plaintiff was able to bring the cause of action, was entitled to summary judgment, claiming that the contract was violative of the anti-kickback statute.
Look, you've claimed that the safe harbor provision here wasn't meant to apply to passive investors.
That's correct.
Like Dr. DiBartolo.
Right.
But in fact, Dr. DiBartolo is a doctor and is in a position to refer patients to HealthSouth. And as such, it would seem to me that he would be precluded from the safe harbor because he certainly is in a position to make or influence referrals directly or indirectly. And you know, as I recall, that's, you know, direct quotes.
Actually not. He is a surgeon physician and who does not have the ability to use this facility. And what the anti-kickback statute and the...
I think you're missing the question. Judge Rovner said, refer patients.
Right. And
the fact that he can't perform the services himself is not relevant.
Right. Well, but what they are looking at with respect to the anti-kickback statute in the safe harbor is that it's to prevent investors from referring to other people. Why would a surgeon who could perform procedures on his own be referring surgeries out?
There's too much work for him to do. He refers the patient to somebody else and receives a portion of the fee through his partnership interest. Now, that may or may not be true.
And I think that's a factual question, too.
Trying to talk over a judge asking a question is not a useful advocacy technique. It may or may not be true for your client in particular, but one could imagine this as a subject of worry for Congress or the agency. Could one not?
Yes. But I think it also presents a factual question under these circumstances, because the factual question here is why he would not have been able to meet the one-third requirement, why he no longer had privileges here, and you get into the issue of not being able to schedule the surgeries here. So, yes, I think he's a passive investor who, in light of the allegations of this complaint, is exactly the kind of investor that is meant to be protected by the anti-kickback statute because he is...
Investors aren't protected by the anti-kickback statute. The federal government is protected by the anti-kickback statute.
But you're right. And I meant to say was that he's exactly the kind of investor who would come within the prohibition of the that they could not kick out because he was not referring.
Look, the Anti-Kickback Act, and I'm going to repeat it again, in this case, was not enacted to regulate conduct between private parties. It's to prevent Medicare fraud against the government. And that's, I think that's kind of key here. No, Will.
I think my time is up then.
Mine too.
Thank you, Mr. Broman. Mr. Gayer.
Thank you, Your Honor. Fortunately, mine is not. And, Your Honor, I don't think you read all these briefs in vain. What's happened here is a change of position about what the complaint is about. Let's start with the jurisdictional issue. Jurisdiction, it is indisputable, is determined from the face of the complaint. And the complaint here explicitly and solely seeks relief under a law of the United States. That's Bell versus Hood, which says that if a complaint is drawn to seek relief under a law of the United States, that is sufficient to support jurisdiction. And again, this court in Turner-Ozen held that jurisdiction is determined from the face of the complaint. This case, this claim, the complaint is not a good complaint under federal law, but it is, in fact, a complaint under federal law. And one way we know this, and it's not the only way, but one way we know this is because that's what they told Judge Zagel on their motion for reconsideration in the court below. And this is item 35 on the docket that's in the record on appeal. And what counsel says in the on the motion for reconsideration is DeBartolo does not raise any violation of state law, but rather raises solely the federal question of whether HealthSouth's forced redemption of his shares could be void and unenforceable as a matter of federal public policy under the anti-kickback statute. So this case, if I may, is McCready. This is a case like in McCready where somebody has raised a claim that is essentially asserting a private right of action under a federal statute when there is no private right of action under a federal statute. And in the, as this court held in McCready, in that circumstance, this court rejected a dismissal for lack of subject matter jurisdiction and held that, in fact, the correct dismissal was for failure to state a claim upon which relief may be granted. Why does that matter? Well, that's the the distinction matters for the very reason that Dr. DeBartolo has changed his position from his ongoing position that he had a private right of action under the anti-kickback statute or under the declaratory judgment statute.
I'm getting a little lost here. DeBartolo's brief says that he has never argued that there was a private right of action under the Anti-Kickback Act. I certainly agree that jurisdiction depends on the state of things when the complaint is filed. But I understood DeBartolo to be saying that he had never made such an argument and had simply been misunderstood as making such an argument.
Well, if so, Judge, then I just must...
How would we be able to separate whether he was actually making that argument from a potential misunderstanding of an argument that was too subtle to be understood by mere mortals?
Your Honor, I just understood. I'm not sure what the answer to your question is. I just understood Mr. Broman to be making that very argument 5 minutes ago when he said that this is that West Allis is distinguishable. The fact that the plaintiff he is bobbing and weaving, but the a fair reading of the complaint and a fair reading of what he has said all along is that this is not a state court claim. It's a very unusual breach of contract claim, which is what he says in his reply brief, that uses neither the word breach nor the word contract anywhere in the complaint.
Look, I assume that you think that if the district court's decision was on the merits, which it certainly looks like it was. It's a bit muddled. Dr. DeBartolo will be precluded from bringing a state contract claim.
That is what I think, Your Honor, and I think that's why the other side has shifted its position.
And now tell me why the dismissal on the merits would be raised judicata as to the state contract claim.
Well, it's the basic rule against claim splitting under principle of res judicata. Every claim that was or could have been brought in the initial action would be he would be stopped from bringing in state court.
Even if there was no jurisdiction to begin with.
No, I think the jurisdiction may be a different issue. I mean, we may have to fight that one out, but I think that that's the nub of this case is that he asserted a claim that on its face is federal. It's a bad federal claim, but he asserted a federal claim. He realized after he lost the case on the merits in the district court that now he was going to be precluded from bringing a state court claim if he has a state court claim, and so he has shifted his position and is now adopting the suggestion that maybe there's no jurisdiction.
Let me make certain. Are you arguing that he's waived today's argument?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. I think that if this court has said anything over the last 20 years, it's that you have an independent duty to assess your jurisdiction and the district court's jurisdiction. So I don't think that it's relevant whether or not Mr. Broman has waived anything. The relevant point is that the claim that he has shifted positions, and the position he's advocating now is not the position advocated in the complaint. And there is subject matter jurisdiction. There is not, however, a good claim under federal law. And I just want to make two points, one about Cox and one about West Allis. With respect to Cox, Your Honor is right. There, the private right of action analysis was a little off point because it was a purely private regulation, a statute regulating private duties. But there's another distinction that I think is quite important, which is that in Cox, what the Seventh Circuit said is you've got two options when you're faced with a statutory scheme and an unenforceable contract. You can obtain the statutory remedy, or you can interpose the unenforceability as a defense if you're sued. Here there is no statutory remedy for a private person, so he's left with exactly the option that we're arguing for here, which is if he were sued, he can interpose it as a defense. That doesn't mean he has a claim as a plaintiff. With respect to West Allis, I would just point out that his distinction of there was enforcement, here there's no enforcement, doesn't hold up. He is attempting to enforce the statute. That is, he is attempting to give effect to its proscriptions. He's just attempting a more limited enforcement than was attempted in West Allis or that the government could enter into.
Now, as I recall, in West Allis, there was no contract between the parties. They had no contractual relationship, so neither party could use the Anti-Kickback Act to void a provision of a contract, which is what Dr. DiBartolo wants to do here. I mean, you know, here, the only question is whether the contract is void.
The question raised in the complaint is whether the contract is void under federal law. But it doesn't matter that this was being invoked in a tort context, and here it's being invoked in a contract context. The fact is that in this context, he is seeking to enforce a federal statute that he doesn't have a right to enforce, and he says so in his reply brief. On page 7, he admits that he's an alternative enforcer. He says that unless and until the government chooses...
I'm not sure how this argument gets you anywhere, because if I understand it correctly, that was your client's view, that your client was free to depart from the terms of the partnership contract in order to enforce your view of the Anti-Kickback Act.
I don't agree with that characterization, Your Honor. There's nothing in the record that suggests that my client departed from Illinois partnership law. There's certainly no complaint about that, and there's certainly no claim for a declaration that Illinois partnership law was violated. I mean, one of the key points here is you can scour this complaint and not find any suggestion that any Illinois law is in play. There's no claim under partnership law. There's no claim under contract law, breach of contract, and there is certainly no claim for rescission, which he also alludes to in his reply brief, but which would get him nowhere because if the contract were rescinded, we'd get our shares back and he'd get his capital back, which is just the situation that he's in now. Finally, I do want to mention the passive investor issue. You're right.
Dr. DeBartolo, according to the terms of the safe harbor, is not a passive investor. He's somebody who can make referrals. And the question here is HealthSouth able to make a bright line determination that everybody who is a doctor should comply with the extension of practice requirement? And I would submit to you that there is nothing in the anti-kickback statute that forbids it, and that the safe harbor provision, since we've adopted what's essentially the safe harbor provision, we are well within our rights to do that. I would respectfully ask that Judge Zagel's determination be affirmed. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Gare. Anything further, Mr. Broman?
Just a few points, Your Honor. With respect to the Cox case, and I think counsel's argument of, well, they're not the ones who brought it, we could raise it as a defense. Well, as Judge Posner acknowledged in the Cox case, it makes no difference.
It makes no difference who writes for the court. If you're referring to Judge Posner separately, presumably it's a concurrence or dissent and doesn't count at all.
Okay. Well, as this court then held, it makes no difference, however, whether the contract is rescinded in a suit for rescission or by the successful interposition of a defense. The point being that the district court did try to make a distinction about whether or not someone could raise these issues only as a defendant as opposed to bringing them as a plaintiff. I think it's very curious that the only cases in the federal court system that either party has been able to find interpreting this statute under circumstances where you have a contract and where the argument has been held, has been raised that the contract is void as against the policy.
Thank you, Mr. Broman.
Thank you.
The case will be taken under advisement.